From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 10th day of December 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel at Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. I'll update you on the agricultural news for the day. Robert Lighthizer was on Face the Nation over the weekend, and he says that 90-day end of March 1 deadline is hard and that at the end of that, tariffs will be going up. We'll hear more about that. We'll also discuss the Farm Bill. It looks like it might just get done during the lame duck session, and we'll hear about the fault lines of the Farm Bill. A brand new book has been authored by Jonathan Kappas here on the campus of the U of I. Oh, and as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast with the folks at Risk Pulse in Chicago, and we'll check in with the Andersons to see what's up with the cash grain markets right here in Champaign County on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media's Public Radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, to discuss the trade in Chicago for the day. Thanks, Kurt, for being with us. What's your assessment for this Monday afternoon?
Yeah, the trade's kind of waiting for some news here, whether it's Chinese news or some news out of this report. The report tomorrow is kind of a non-eventful report. The trend has been for the January to be a little bit more dynamic. Not saying we can't see a surprise tomorrow, but corn ending stocks are expected to be just about unchanged at near this 1.743 area or so. And bean ending stocks maybe down 10 million bushels, down about 945 million bushels, which is quite a significant amount. And that's kind of why we're leaning towards that this Chinese news needs to happen here fairly quickly to confirm we'll probably hopefully take up a little old export business. Trade estimates anywhere from 5 to 8 million metric tons of Chinese business coming towards us, and part of that's going to be old crop, and the other half's probably going to be new crop. So if we can see some type of commitment here fairly quickly, we could probably see anywhere from 180 million to 200 million bushels of old crop beans going to Asia, which would lower that carryout down to 750 million bushels if they increase the exports that much. And that would be helpful, but we still have a lot of bean inventory to work through. World numbers expected to probably be about just unchanged. The thing is, tomorrow, too, the Brazilian reporting agency is going to release some Brazilian numbers, and those numbers are expected to be strong out of the Southern Hemisphere, Todd.
So the trade seems not to have made too much note, at least yet, for the grains of the problems that the U.S. could encounter with the Huawei executive that was held over in Canada today, or over the weekend. Do we expect that they're just waiting to see what happens with her over time?
Well, the talk is it's two separate issues, and the verbal agreement or the agreement reached prior to that is going to be worked on first or held pushed through for, say, whereas this other, we'll have to see how the legal system unfolds here as we move forward through here. From one country to another country, whenever a country has holding someone, it's a concern. But two, they need to go through the system here of posting bail or try to post bail and so forth. So we'll see what happens here. That took the market defensively last week there. We've stabilized since then, so that shows that the market's real sensitive to these issues as we move forward here.
Anything you've been watching for the livestock side?
Basically, the livestock numbers, the hog reports expected to show 3% more numbers. Production is supposed to be up 3%, but overall demand continues to be relatively strong. Continued support in the summer months on ideas that we could see some Asian business eventually through here. So those June, July hogs look to maintain a premium here as we move forward here, Todd.
Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Very good. Take care.
Kurt Kimmel joins us from his Bates Commodities office in Normal, Illinois. In today's agricultural news, we'll start with trade in China and the potential for a deal to be done in the next 90 days. By the way, that's a hard deadline, according to Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative. He was on Face the Nation Sunday in a very rare appearance, though he was on NPR on Friday as well. Lighthizer on both programs reiterated that Mr. Trump's priorities for the U.S.-China trade talks were additional market access for U.S. producers and structural changes by China to protect American technology. He simply says no deal equals more tariffs.
If there is a deal that can be made that will require or assure the protection of U.S. technology, the very heartbeat of all of our economy, it's not just technology, it's everything from services to manufacturing, even farming is a technology industry now in the United States. We will protect that technology and get additional market access from China. If that can be done, the president wants us to do it. If not, we'll have tariffs.
Trump has said he would increase tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods from 10% to 25% after the 90-day period.
It is a very important matter, and there's a long history of having things not work out.
Lighthizer also joined other Trump administration officials in playing down how much the arrest of Huawei's CFO in Canada would hurt trade negotiations with China. Well, let's switch gears now and move from trade to the Farm Bill. The conference committee members apparently are signing that bill today, and it should go to the House and the Senate for a vote before it goes to the president. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth on Friday in Taylorville, Illinois, was touring some of the damage that was done by the tornado and had this to say about the potential for the Farm Bill to pass in the lame duck session.
Every sense that I get is that we will have the Farm Bill and that we will pass it. I spoke with Debbie Stabenow. I've been pushing some extremely important issues for the people here in Illinois, for our soybean and our corn growers. And we have every confidence that we're going to be able to pass this. When I left, when we ended yesterday, it was on a good footing as far as the Farm Bill was concerned. So I'm hoping we'll get to vote on it next week. Maybe the week after, hopefully.
Any issues outstanding that need to be worked on?
I think everything has been worked on so far, but I'm not on the committee, so I couldn't tell you if there are any. I'm not in on the negotiations, but I've not heard of any red flags so far.
That's Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat. She was touring damage in Taylorville, Illinois, last Friday afternoon. And finally today, Bob Berglund, who was Agriculture Secretary under President Jimmy Carter, died yesterday at the age of 90. The northern Minnesota farmer was tasked with selling Carter's unpopular Soviet Union grain embargo. USDA's Rod Bain has more.
Tributes and honors have continued since Sunday for the Minnesota native, farmer, politician, and 20th U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Bob Berglund.
We can easily meet whatever Russian demands there may be without any devastating impact to the consumer, but it probably will bring prices up somewhat to the producer.
Berglund, from a 1977 press conference on discussing a shortage to the then Soviet Union's wheat crop and how that would impact U.S. supplies after purchase. Secretary Berglund's tenure in office was also known for another issue with the Soviets, our nation's 1980 grain embargo to that market in response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, as well as for his introduction of the first ever set of USDA dietary guidelines for Americans.
There are no absolutes in these guidelines. We are simply trying to advise people on how to stay healthy through a proper diet.
The former agriculture secretary passed away Sunday in his hometown of Roseau, Minnesota, at the age of 90. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And that's a look at today's agricultural news. We're now joined by University of Illinois agricultural policy specialist Jonathan Kappas. He's just penned a brand new book that you can buy on Amazon if you'd like. Jonathan, what's the title of the book and why did you write it?
The second part of that question is a lot more difficult. The title of the book is Fault Lines of Farm Policy, and it's a legislative and political history of the Farm Bill. So it traces the history of farm policy and farm bill development all the way back to post-World War I and the first collapse, and then runs it all the way up through the 2014 Farm Bill effort.
So I take it you go back all the way to the 1930s then?
Yeah, I mean, I go pre-1930s because there's some before the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, which is kind of the first real farm bill that we had under the New Deal with Roosevelt. There was about a 12-year fight in Congress to try to do something for farmers. So if you think about prices collapsed after World War I. And so throughout the 1920s, everything's going great for the economy, the roaring 20s, but the farmers were in an economic depression with post-war price collapses. And so there was about five different attempts to get legislation passed, and they failed or got vetoed every time. And so I give a little bit of that sort of as background, and then really start picking things up in the 33 Act.
Yeah, are there milestones along the way that make a big difference? I mean, that's the first one.
That's the first one. There are, if you think about it, there are, I tried to break it up into like, when I think about it, I try to do like three eras, if you will. So we have this sort of New Deal parity system, which we created in the 30s. It runs all the way to 1973. But during that time, it falls apart. It breaks down. There's all kinds of problems and fights that are pretty fascinating for a historical geek like myself.
American agriculture movement.
Farm Bill 101, yep. Right? A lot of disputes regionally between Midwest, South, Western Plains folks. So you see a lot of that play out. And then 1973, we have this price spike coming after Nixon and the wheat deal with Russia or Soviet Union at the time. And so in 73, they switched to target prices. And so that's a big milestone in 1973. Target prices run to 1996, which is the Freedom to Farm Federal Agriculture Improvement Reform Act of 1996 decouples payments and ends the target price. So those are kind of your three big, what I sort of think of as the three big markers, the beginning, the switch to target prices in 73, and then the decoupling of programs in 96, which we're still using the base acre decoupled system that we started then.
The fault lines are where now?
Well, the fault lines, so it's sort of, the idea of the fault line. So the idea of legislation in general is you got to come up with a coalition. You got to get through Congress and get the votes. So you need to create a coalition or build a coalition to get your votes. And it's where you bring these interests together. I sort of talk about that as your fault line. So if you think about the original fault line, it's between cotton in the South, corn in the Midwest, and wheat out West. And where they come together and how they sort of compete and have conflict right on that sort of fault line metaphor is where you see a lot of that. The second one then, of course, is with food assistance. So the old food stamp program that's now SNAP, it comes into play in 1964 and then is added to the Farm Bill in 1973. And so this creates a whole nother fault line as between the farm interest community, the rural representatives in particular, and urban and suburban. And so that kind of creates our second major fault line. And if you think conservation policy, which really kind of the big landmark for that was 1985. And so that kind of adds a third one. And then you think, as we think about farm bills now, those are the three kind of pillars of our coalition to get a farm bill done. What are we doing for the farm commodity groups? What's going on in conservation? And of course, what's going on with nutrition and food assistance? And you can just see them play out. And so the 2014 farm bill, I think, provided, and obviously I'm a little biased since I worked on it a bit, but it provided a real solid example of what happens when budget pressures in particular put a lot of pressure on these fault lines. So we saw the fight in the Senate between the South and the Midwest over farm programs. You saw the fight in the House between Republicans and Democrats over SNAP. And so you kind of see that play out as a pretty strong example of this concept.
Yeah, and they're still in play today, and they play out in wildly different ways sometimes.
It's fascinating. Yeah, what's fascinating to me going back through this is how many things get recycled over time, but the way they get recycled and the way what it produces is pretty interesting. So you see that you can go back. I looked a lot extensively at the congressional record. So I was going back through the debates for each of these farm bills on the House and Senate floor to try to get an understanding of what were the members fighting about? What was pressing on them from constituents? How were they interpreting it and how were they negotiating it? And it's funny, some of that you hear some of these same lines again and again, and which makes sense when you think of how cyclical the markets are and how much of the farm policy, the program effort has been trying to address low prices. So particularly you see those price declines, you're going to hear a lot of the same concerns come up. I've been working on it pretty extensively for the last three or four years. So it's been a bit of a long project.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it. I'll buy a copy. Where do I do that at, by the way?
Well, thank you for that. It's quite extensive. It's available from the University of Nebraska Press, so it's available online. You can order through them, or Amazon, of course, will have it. I don't know other stores. I don't really know how they're distributing it. My guess is it's mostly online.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Todd.
That's Jonathan Kappas from the University of Illinois talking about his brand new book, The Fault Lines of Farm Policy, A Legislative and Political History of the Farm Bill. Let's check now the cash grain market with Amy Sage from the Andersons. Hey, good afternoon to you, Amy. Thanks for being with us. What's been happening at the Andersons today?
As far as the market goes, it's been a little bit stale here. Really, we haven't seen a lot of basis changes here for a week or so. We have been seeing a little bit of improvement, gradual improvement in corn, a little bit more as we rolled out of the December contract at the end of November and into the March. But as far as seeing new real values and that type of thing improve, we just really haven't seen anything too exciting kind of compared to the futures market here as well. So just a little bit stale, not a lot of excitement around that right now.
Now, not this past weekend, but the previous weekend, President Trump and President Xi sat down. Mr. Trump says that the Chinese agreed to make immediate buys of agricultural products. Do we have any feelers yet at this point, do you think?
We don't, actually, right now. And I think that we're seeing, obviously, the market react to that a little bit here. Beans gradually creeping lower, down 6 cents on the board today. I think everybody's kind of waiting to see some purchases from China, and we're just not hearing any news at this point. Everything's pretty limited, not being able to confirm any deals at this point. Has really kind of let the wind out of some sails here. So I think the market's definitely going to be closely watching for that. We've got a USDA WASDE tomorrow at 11. So we'll see if we see exports affected and how the USDA is going to evaluate this news and see what changes they make to the export numbers based on the meeting that we had a week and a half ago.
With hindsight back to Monday last week, and I know you folks were really busy on the phone lines, probably making some purchases of soybeans. How much of the crop do you think you ended up buying in the area in total? Did farmers sort of finish everything out? Did they sell just a small increment on that day? And how much do they have left to market?
So overall, I think we probably... some people sold more than others, obviously, but probably weighted out, I would say it was probably about 15%, really. We saw some cleanup sales happen, people who were getting some overruns sold, people who were selling a little bit of what they needed for cash flow purposes, rewarding the market. But it really kind of depended, I think, on what percent people had going into that rally already sold and what percent is still on farm. We really didn't buy a ton of tour-arrived beans coming, off the farm that people are storing because they aren't paying any charges on those, but more people stopping charges on what they had in the elevator for the most part to reward that rally. Really, a lot of what we've been hearing is people waiting for an announcement of any type of second half of the MFP payment to help support a sale. I think psychologically, knowing that they were getting a little bit more would really help encourage some sales.
Yes, and on that note, that's yet to come. I thought maybe Friday or today we'd see something from it, but not to this point.
Not yet. Yeah, still crickets.
that's right.
We'll see what ends up happening with that.
Well, what are your bids for the day?
You bet. Cash corn today is going to be 362, cash soybeans 860, 860, and cash wheat is at 501.
Hey, thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you.
That's Amy Sage. She is with the Andersons, joins us here in the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Monday afternoon. Don't forget to pick up your tickets. This is the last day to do it online for the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. You can do that at the Farm Doc Daily website, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Starting a week from today, I'll be on the road with the agricultural economist at five cities across the state. We're now joined by Mark Russo. He's at Brisk Pulse in Chicago. Mark, thanks for being with us. Let's start in South America. What are weather conditions like there today?
Well, Todd, across South America, weather conditions are in really good shape. at this time. We've seen adequate rainfall across Argentina and Brazil. And coming up from a macro perspective, we see more opportunities for rain across the vast majority of summer crop acreage and an overall lack of heat. And that should keep growing conditions in good shape from now basically through the end of the month. Now, northern Brazil will be turning less active relative to recent weeks, but again, they've been actually wetter than normal over the past several weeks. So that turn to less active conditions is not of any concern at this time.
Normal and good remains the words to go with for South America. How about here in the United States? We had, boy, kind of a rough winter storm that made its way across the southern part of the U.S. over the weekend.
Yeah, and then that storm system, which basically moved from coast to coast, initially producing heavy rains in areas of California, including Southern California, and then a swath of ice and snow from the southern plains eastward to the Carolinas. We did see some record snow in areas of the Texas Panhandle, kind of centered in Lubbock, which recorded over 10 inches of snow, one of the earliest major snow events in Lubbock's history with that storm. And then the other item was the 12 to 24 inches of snow in areas of the Carolinas, which produced some power outages, obviously transportation difficulties here. That storm system now is beginning to wrap up here as it moves off into the East Coast, but certainly had some high impact from logistics, transportation, and even some business disruptions here in areas of the southern U.S.
I take it the second half of December will be more moderate?
We do see indications here of a much quieter pattern, at least from a temperature perspective, meaning that actually temperatures are going to be warming up and a much milder Pacific base low is going to prevail over the next couple of weeks, which basically takes us through Christmas. Now, from a storminess standpoint, there still will be some waves of low pressure tracking through, but with the milder pattern, actually much of the precip will be falling as rain compared to snow. And in fact, over the upcoming weekend, there will be a storm system here in the middle of the country. However, again, producing primarily rain rather than snow. So we don't see any big storm systems or snow systems here in the middle of the country. One area that will be seeing some higher snow totals, that's going to be the Pacific Northwest. And actually, they've been in a much drier pattern now for many, many months. And this is going to be the most active that the Pacific Northwest has seen really since at times even going back to earlier this year. And so mountain snows, also some valley rain activity there. But that's really one of the most active areas here in the U.S. from now through the Christmas holiday.
Hey, thanks so much for taking the time with me today.
Yeah, you're welcome, Todd.
And of course, is Mark Russo. He is with Risk Pulse out of Chicago, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. I'm Todd Gleason.